right, we're going to go ahead and get started now with our program. Thank you all for being here. This is the 12th annual Bar Historians Luncheon, and it's very good to see such a good crowd today. I'm Marilyn May. I'm the chair of the committee, and I wanted to thank all of you for being here and thank our moderator and panelists for being here. I'm really looking forward to this topic. It's going to be very interesting. I want to mention the names of the subcommittee of our group who planned this event. Mike Schweiger, I know Buck Sterling is here, and Joe Darnell, Joe's here, and Barb Hood, and myself. And then would the members of the bar, all the members who are here of the Bar Historians Committee, please stand? And this isn't even all of us. It's a nice big committee. It's really fun to be on. Thank you all for your work. There's a little description of the committee on the back of your program and suggestions of ways that you could help. You could donate your time by taking an oral history of a friend or a colleague or someone you know that might have interesting things to say about their contributions to the legal community. You could contribute items if you have interesting things from your career. We have a joint archive, bench bar archive, that's kept at the Alaska State Law Library. And Beth Odson, who is here, kind of heads up the group that catalogs and organizes and keeps track of all those things. Or you could also donate some money. We have oral histories still that have not been transcribed, and of course that's a lot easier to make use of them if we have a transcript. So those are different ways that you could help us. I want to mention that the CLE Certificate of Compliance will be emailed to everybody. You don't see them on the table, but they will come to you. And also announce that after the session is over, if any former public defender, assistant public defenders or public defenders would hang around, we'd like to get a group photo for historical purposes. So now I'd like to introduce our panel. First, the moderator, Michael Schweiger. He's an attorney with the Public Defender Agency Appeals Division and graduated from Cornell and received his master's degree in history and his law degree from Duke University. And I asked him, I know that he served as a law clerk to Judge Morse, but I asked if that was his first job in Alaska, and actually his first job was at the Hobbycraft. In the Diamond Center, because he's an actual Alaskan. And I also want to mention that Mike is the author of an article that just came out this week in the Western Legal History, which is the Journal of the Ninth Circuit Historical Society. The article is called Mining for Citizens, Race, Resources, and the Republic in the Alaska Gold Rush. And I just started reading it yesterday, but it's very interesting. And then our panel, Judge Larry Card, is a retired Superior Court judge from Anchorage, and he still serves as a pro tem judge helping us out. He's the first African-American judge in Alaska. Before becoming a judge, he served as assistant U.S. attorney for the District of Alaska and also in the U.S. Air Force Judge Advocate General Corps. And you can actually read all the details on your program. I'm just hitting a few highlights here. Rich Kirtner on the end is the federal defender for Alaska. He's been a federal defender for 40 years and was appointed the federal defender in 1996. Karen Loeffler, I don't know why I didn't do this in order. I'm sorry, I had it in this order on my sheet. This was dumb. Karen Loeffler is the United States Attorney for the District of Alaska. She was appointed in 2009 but had served as an assistant U.S. attorney since 1989, including a couple of stints as the chief of the criminal division, and also had some time in private practice. And then Quinlan Steiner, who's in the middle because this makes no sense, is the public defender for the state of Alaska. And he's held that job since 2005, but he's been with the Public Defender Agency since 1998. And serves on a couple of committees, the Criminal Rules Committee and the Criminal Justice Working Group, and has taught criminal procedure at UAA. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mike, and you can get going. Remember to stay at the end for the door prizes and any public defender folks for the photo.
Thank you, Marilyn. And public advocates, too, anyone who's done indigent defense, please stay afterwards for a photo. Thank you all for coming. The program today is going to be a panel of presenters with some discussion and questions. There will be a chance for questions from the floor at the end of the presentations. The program is being audio recorded, though, so if you would please wait for a microphone to get to you, then we can record your question, and then people will better understand the answer that is given by the presenters. As Marilyn said, this is an annual event, and we're so happy to see you here in commemoration of Gideon. We do a number of other events, CLEs, and oral history projects, as Marilyn said, and we also do archival work occasionally on Wednesdays. And archives are, may seem like kind of a dry pursuit, but occasionally you do find some gems in the archives. And I won't pretend that you feel like Indiana Jones. That's not the case. But you really can find some neat things. And when I was in the National Archives, I found recently two documents that I thought I'd share with you today as we think about Gideon. The first is a letter, and the second is a press release. So the first is a letter dated November 14th, 1962. It's written by John Havelock, and it says it's addressed to the Honorable Attorney General Edward McCormick, who's the Attorney General of Massachusetts. And in the letter, Havelock writes, "Attorney General Walter Mondale of Minnesota has been kind enough to wire asking if we would join in the amicus brief filed by you in Gideon versus Cochran. Although our sympathies are with the position apparently taken by Massachusetts, we do not feel that we can join in a brief without having read it. If you could please send us a copy of your brief, we would be prepared if, as I suspect, the brief coincides with the position of Alaska. To telegraph the Supreme Court indicating our wish to join in the brief, even if there is not now time for us to join before filing." 2 weeks later, there's a press release written by the state of Alaska on November 28, 1962. "The state of Alaska has joined with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts in a friend of the court brief before the Supreme Court of the United States in an important civil rights case. The case, Gideon versus Cochran, which arose in the state of Florida, involves the right of an indigent defendant charged with a felony to have adequate counsel, despite his inability to pay. In an older case, Betts versus Brady, a divided Supreme Court, said that the right to a fundamentally fair trial, included in the concept of due process protected by the 14th Amendment, did not include the right to counsel, except in a case punishable by death. In the present case, the Supreme Court is being asked to reassess that decision and expand the concept of due process to protect the indigent defendant faced with a long term of imprisonment. The new rule, which the Attorney General is supporting, reflects present law and practice in Alaska. The Supreme Court is expected to hear arguments in this case in the present term, and a decision may be expected in the spring." So just a couple of neat documents from the archives, and if you have documents, old letters, if you have old photos, we want to get a hold of those, get a hold of copies of them, get a hold of the originals to make sure that they're kept safe. These can be shared then with historians of the future. So I mentioned in both documents a case called Gideon versus Cochran. Of course, we're here today for Gideon versus Wainwright. And I think that Rich Kirtner will be able to talk about why Gideon versus Cochran and Gideon versus Wainwright are the same case. Rich, you want to start?
Well, thank you. Good afternoon, everybody.
If you hit your...
Can you hear me now? Good afternoon, everybody. It's an honor, I guess, to be recognized as a historian of my profession, I am honored to be here and to have so many people here. Just reminds me, I just bought one of those little magnetic refrigerator magnets for a friend that said, "I may be old, but I got to see all the cool bands." So you might see it at Side Street next time you're there. Anyway, if you come into my office, as you get off the elevator, you will not see a big sign that says Federal Public Defender for the District of Alaska. You'll see instead a poster blown up of a handwritten petition by Earl Gideon. Because for public defenders, we sort of see that as a source of what we do, some of the roots of what we do. And it's kind of ironic in this year, the 50th anniversary of Gideon, that this is when I think the public defender systems nationwide are in jeopardy, especially the federal defender offices, be with the sequester, with the budget crisis in Congress, and the funding for CJA and federal defender offices. It's been a real concern. I think that federal defender offices have been the model nationwide of a well-funded and well-trained defender offices, and it's been at risk this past year. So even though Gideon is dear to my heart, I thought I'd, I don't really know the case, and I did some research. I did a presentation earlier this year at the university, so I put together a little slideshow of what I've learned about the case. Of course, everybody, I think, knows what the case stands for, and this right to counsel case began in this little pool room in Florida, in Panama City. I wish I could brought up the there's some old TV footage of Earl Gideon being interviewed like on CBS television in back in the day, and they have a picture of him shooting pool in his pool hall after his case was decided. I noticed as a public defender that he didn't make a shot the whole time he was on. But this is the pool hall, and this is Mr. Gideon. He was a 50-year-old drifter, and he was charged with stealing beer, wine, and coins from this pool hall. He actually lived in a little housing place next door to this, and he became the suspect when things were missing because he was a regular at the pool hall. So he asked for a lawyer, and Florida said you don't have a lawyer unless there's a death penalty. And so he, this is an old postcard from back then that shows the courthouse where he was tried, and he represented himself, and he received a 5-year sentence. It wasn't a mandatory minimum either. So, and then he did his time in this prison in Florida. This, I guess, speaks to some of our history of prisons, and this, they made license plates there. So I thought that was kind of an interesting backstory to this whole case. But this is what you'll see in my office, a blow-up of this particular handwritten petition, which Mr. Gideon prepared, and this is like, I guess the holy grail for public defenders. This is what started the Gideon decision and the protection of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. Some of the interesting things I learned is that, sometimes your name becomes associated with a landmark case, and how that happens can be, it can be serendipity. And as it turned out, that Mr. Cochran was the original head of the Department of Corrections for Florida during the whole process of this. But between the time it was argued and the decision came out, Mr. Wainwright became the head of the Department of Corrections, and that's now his name is on the case forever. Just to show you it's a small world, the young lawyer who argued that for the state of Florida was Bruce Jacob. It was ironic to me because Mr. Jacob later became a professor at the Ohio State University School of Law. He was the director of the clinical programs there. He was actually the director of the clinical programs when I was a law student in Columbus, Ohio, and I would do work with the clinic. So I got to know Bruce then, and later on I worked at that same clinic myself before I moved to Alaska. But Bruce Jacob will always be known as the lawyer who argued against Gideon. So, and John Hart Ely, who was a law clerk for Abe Fortas, he was prepared to argue on behalf of Mr. Gideon. I thought it was somewhat ironic that he ended up being a federal public defender in San Diego later on in his career. So this was the Supreme Court that unanimously decided Gideon. And it was Judge Black, Justice Black, who wrote the opinion. And, you know, sometimes when you look at some of the older Supreme Court decisions, you can still be inspired. So some of what he wrote in that decision, I read again, and to me it's still inspiring. Hits home is the fact that the first sentence, government, both state and federal, spend vast sums of money to establish machinery to try defendants accused of crime. Well, I think that was true then. I think it's even more true now. I think it's notable that it recognizes lawyers as being an essential part of making sure the system works, and that few defendants would be able to hire the best lawyers they could afford. That's most defendants would want to hire the best lawyer they could afford, and it's for most that's just not possible. I know that's been my basically, my concept in running my office is that I know somebody who gets charged with a federal crime wants and needs the best lawyer they could possibly get, and that's who I try to have on my staff. And I think that this language also emphasizes that this Sixth Amendment right to counsel, the importance of public defenders making sure the system works it may not be in all countries, but it is in ours. So I think that the language of Gideon is just as important as the decision to me. And then Mr. Gideon won his case, went back to trial, had a lawyer this time, and was acquitted. The one of the backstories I heard about was that the lawyer that was appointed actually had a cousin on the jury. And so that may have helped. Anyway, so I was really interesting to just do that research and find out more about the story about Earl Gideon. Well, what's my experience been as since I became a public defender? I started actually in law school back in the early 70s. And as 10 years as a public defender, what I remember, what really bothered me when I first started was having client after client say, I don't want a public defender, you know. It's like, I want a real lawyer. And back then, public defenders served, you know, it was basically like being in the Army, 2 years and then you're out. And that was kind of the concept of them. And I just couldn't stand the thought that if I was a public defender, I would be better than any other lawyer doing the same kind of case because I'm a specialist at it. And that's been something that's driven me. I remember back in the day, too, our training program was, you know, here's all your cases, go to court, and good luck. And I've always been an advocate since then of having good training programs for public defenders. And my office manages the CJ panel of private attorneys that do federal work, and we try to train as much as we possibly can. Somehow I ended up in Alaska, thank you, Dana Fabe, after 10 years as a public defender, I went to the law school and taught in the clinical programs at Ohio State University, and Dana recruited me to come up to Alaska, and my impressions were, one, the state public defender could double my salary from the law school. That was cool. But also, more important than that, there was really a strong office here. People had stayed quite a bit. John Salemi in Venable, Vermont were my, you know, go-to guys as trial lawyers, true warriors. And they were well-funded, and it was a great community. And I was really just proud to be part of that community. In the 90s, I was lucky to be a federal public defender, where we were able to have more and more resources to do our job. And I've always enjoyed working as a public defender, even back in the day, and especially now in my office. What's my takeaway from all this experience? I guess sometimes we just assume we have this constitutional right, we have this Supreme Court case, we have something that's we can always count on, and I think as soon as you take something for granted, you have to be concerned about keeping it. And that's what I see right now nationally in the federal system of the attack on funding for federal public defender offices. And so I am not as familiar with the state. I worry about state funding for training for young lawyers. And I think that from my perspective, we always have to be vigilant to protect what I think is an essential constitutional right in that we have in this country that we need to protect and honor. So that's my takeaway from all my experience.
Thanks, Rich. One question I had for you, and if the other panelists want to answer too, then please do. But there's some recent scholars, not many, but a few, have raised a question about whether or not Gideon hand wrote his own petition, or whether or not his cellmate wrote his petition for him. and these folks have identified a cellmate who was a judge, who was convicted for conspiring to kill another judge. So, an expert in the legal field. And does it make a difference how we think of Gideon, how we think of the man, how we think of the case, if he didn't write the petition and if, in fact, a jailhouse judge did?
Well, I'd be surprised a judge could write a petition that well. No, just kidding. I don't know if it made a difference. I mean, in my experience in looking at some of the cases that have been constitutional landmark cases, I mean, who was Miranda? Who was Earl Gideon? Did Gideon write it himself or somebody else? Who argued the case? You know, it could be the attorney for the state of Florida was actually a dyed-in-the-wool progressive liberal attorney through his career. So I don't know if it would – I don't think it would have made a difference. I think this type of issue had to be addressed at some point, and I think Earl Gideon was in the, I guess, the perfect storm to be a historic person, you know, based on that case.
Anyone else want to chime in on that? No? Well, thank you, Rich. I think you hit the nail on the head talking about the importance of the constitutional right, and Quinlan Steiner is going to talk next about the implementation of that constitutional right and how we do it in this state versus in other states.
Thank you. My name is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the public defender for the state of Alaska. Mike asked me to speak a little bit about what it was like before and after the public defender agency and how it came to be. I know I'm speaking to some folks here who practiced before and after the agency, so I hope I'm getting everything right. But the question that flowed from Gideon was often a more mundane but a very interesting question about just the finances of how this works and how the implementation would work to increase the quality of the representation. And that really drove much of the debate and drove it from the bar itself. As some of you might remember, prior to the Public Defender Agency, attorneys were appointed directly by the court. I had several conversations with my uncle about this, and he said it was dangerous strolling through the courtroom in a civil case because you might just get snapped up. And he handled his fair share of cases. He would have preferred not to and thought it was best that he didn't. But he had an obligation, and he fulfilled it. But the financial aspect of it is kind of interesting. Prior to the public defender, attorneys were paid $50 for a plea and $50 for a trial in addition if you couldn't get it. That changed later to an hourly rate of $10 for trial prep and $15 for the trial itself, which proved to be inadequate even in the 1960s. Attorneys were working as much as 33 days a year on appointed cases at a reduced rate, and it was compromising their practice, and that really drove a lot of it. And in fact, one example is an attorney who spent a month on a case was compensated $250, whose office expenses were $1,000, and that person actually had to take out a bank loan just to shoulder the burden of that case. And one interesting statistic of this whole thing is in 1962, the attorneys of the state provided $238,000 in services on appointed cases, but were compensated only $13,500 for those services. And in that same year, the total budget for investigation, travel, and experts was $130. These cases were not being addressed in the way that they should, and the bar recognized that, and many members of the bars recognized that. And following the Gideon decision, the legislature actually addressed it right away and attempted to propose creating a public defender agency in 1963, although it didn't really gain any purchase and it didn't go anywhere. It wasn't until the bar actually got involved in 1967, the Anchorage Bar, and I'm going to list the folks that did this, Leroy Barker, Robert Irwin, William Fold, James Singleton, Dennis Lazarus, Robert Ely, and William Jacobs drafted what is now the Public Defender Act. They were, the Anchorage Bar got together and was preparing to pitch this. The Tanana Valley Bar Association got involved, Stephen Delisio, drafted some amendments to what the Anchorage Bar had drafted, which were progressive at the time and included extending representation down to less than serious cases. And Alaska has a history of being ahead of the curve on these issues. At the time, Gideon did not cover all cases, but Alaska was seeking to cover all cases where you were facing jail time. They eventually met with the Anchorage Bar and agreed on a proposal. But what happened was there were two proposals that were created. One was to create the Public Defender Agency. The other one was to simply pay the appointed lawyers a little bit more. Nobody liked getting a little bit more. Everyone thought primarily that what needed to occur was to create an agency of specialists, criminal defense specialists, who could focus their resources on these cases. But it was viewed that would be politically unpalatable because it was more expensive to create a public defender agency than just to pay a little bit more. So the Judicial Council and the Bar Association debated this about what proposal to put forward. Eventually, the Bar Association was convinced that the public defender agency was the means to do this. And the concern was the unequal experience that appointed lawyers would provide for criminal defendants, as well as the disproportionate resources of a state agency prosecuting cases and individual lawyers trying to shoulder the burden of that without the resources. So the bar eventually got behind this proposal. They estimated the costs at $400,000 to provide lawyers, and the legislature promptly appropriated $260,000. And in fact,
that was a different time.
It was a different time. The budget has grown a little bit. Now, what's interesting about that is the chairman of the Judicial Council noted upon the passing of the act, I'm going to quote this because I think it really puts a lot of texture to the whole thing. "Whoever will be appointed public defender will certainly have troubles as a result of adequate funds, and that this should be published to the bar so that its members would have compassion for the office." In 1968, right before the act was passed, there were 411 criminal cases that received an appointed lawyer. By 1972, that had risen to 4,000 cases. and program costs exceeded appropriations in every year that I've studied, and that has continued on. And I would like to say one other comment about the creation and the result of it. It was analyzed, and the report was written in 1975, addressing the first 4 years to see how well it was implemented and what changes could be made. And there was intense pressure and lots of discussion in the Judicial Council's report from 1975. But what was described as a result of this by one survey respondent of all the pressure that it was under was this, and I've remembered this quote. The PD is like the bumblebee. By all theories of aerodynamics, it can't fly, but somehow it does. You know, the history started at the very beginning. The lawyers that have done this work have been dedicated to it. And the continuing pressure on criminal appointments grows. Last year, we had approximately 26,000 appointments. And to put that to perspective, if the appointed system still existed, all lawyers who are active members of the bar in Alaska would have to take 10 cases each every year, which might not sound like a lot until you realize that you'd have to learn that whole area of law before you address even the smallest of those cases. And as anyone who's done this work knows, even parole violations and probation violations and the easiest of misdemeanors are quite complicated very quickly. One aspect I'd like to talk about is the actual creation of the public defender. There were, and the first public defender, who I believe is in the audience, is Vic Carlson here? I'd just like to recognize Vic Carlson as the first appointed public defender. There were 9 applicants and 3 nominations. Marvin Frankel, who was the U.S. Attorney for Alaska, Harold Toby, who was the Assistant District Attorney for Anchorage, and Mr. Carlson, who was the Anchorage Borough Attorney. Governor Keith Miller, on June 20th, 1969, appointed Victor Carlson to that position. One notable applicant who didn't get through the council, though achieved some national notoriety 3 years later for his arrest for marijuana possession, and the privacy issues and constitutional issues that arose from there. At the time the agency was created, there were 5 attorneys hired in Fairbanks, Anchorage, Juneau, and Ketchikan to cover the entire state, and they were paid approximately $19,000 a year to cover those cases. To say that it was a challenge to cover a territory the size of Alaska is certainly an understatement. The first public defenders who were hired were Dick Madsen, David Backstrom in Fairbanks, James Gilmore and Francis Kernan in Anchorage, and Colin Middleton in Ketchikan. I'm really not sure who was in Anchorage, unless I mean in Juneau. I've never been able to figure that out. I would note that James Gilmore's son, Chester Gilmore, eventually also came to work for the Public Defender Agency. We have been around that long. The public defender itself and the agency as a delivery system was progressive at the time and remains to be somewhat unique in that it's a statewide public defender, which I think the nation as a whole has come to view as the gold standard for delivery of public defender services. It results in the highest consistency of quality defense services. And across the country, indigent defense is handled in many ways. It can be handled at the county level. It can be handled by an appointment level, appointed attorney level. And the ABA and defense organizations that look at this see the statewide public defender as the gold standard. Alaska has just consistently ahead of the curve on these issues. The Judicial Council issued its report to discuss what the impacts were of it, how it was implemented, and what changes can be made. And when I first researched this was back when the agency was a 40-year anniversary, and it was remarkable to me that the issues that were presented in that report remain. But the one thing that I learned was the Judicial Council, which was chaired at the time by Justice Rabinowitz, had recommendations not just for the Public Defender Agency. The Public Defender Agency had numerous recommendations. Much of them were technical in how they responded to the challenges of underfunding, training, and controls, and not that interesting. But what interested me about it was their recommendation for the bar and the court system with regard to the agency. And I'm going to quote from the report just because I think it brings a lot of texture into how it was viewed and how quickly the view of the agency changed. The report started off saying, while state and local bar associations were eager and active to promote the creation of a public defender agency in 1969, their involvement since has declined into a relationship most kindly identified as benign neglect. The agency was in many ways left on its own to defend itself, and the report acknowledged that, saying, perhaps one of the most serious voids created when criminal defense practice is left to a public agency is the loss of involvement by private attorneys in the injustices of the criminal process and the loss of an effective political voice in achieving necessary substantive changes in criminal law. When private attorneys get their hands dirty in daily criminal law practice, more dialogue and greater pressure for reform comes sooner. The legal profession has no more important or pressing task than to see to it that adequate provision is made everywhere to ensure that competent counsel are provided for indigent defendants. It was a very strong statement, in my view, and they urged the bar to ensure that the agency is not criticized as a less politically powerful scapegoat for the weaknesses in the court system, judges, prosecution, or the police. It urged the bar to assist the agency in its training needs and utilize its lobbying capabilities to support legislation, financial appropriations, and other necessary legislation to assist the agency. These things are important. As Rich said, occasionally the public defender systems around the country come under assault, and it is a daily and annual event to make sure that the quality of representation is commensurate with what we all expect and what the Constitution requires. And that has been my experience and my takeaway in trying to ensure that even the system that is best designed to implement these services is designed well. And since I note there's a few judges in the audience, I will note they had one point for the court system, which is they were obligated to ensure the most efficient management of attorney time by adjusting their calendars to favor our needs. So I just put that out there. I would also like to recognize Chief Justice Babe, who is also a former public defender for the state, and may be able to comment on the consistency of the issues that address us. And so I'd be happy to answer any questions or...
Thanks, Gwendolyn. One of the factors about one of the factors influencing our indigent defense in Alaska is with the creation of the public defender system and the Office of Public Advocacy on the state side and the CJA panel on the federal side. Different defendants may get a lawyer at different times. A private attorney might be retained before a charge, or upon arrest or that kind of thing. Public defender might be assigned post-charge, and then an advocate might be assigned after a thorough conflict analysis. Does that affect the quality of the representation that the defendants get, and is it okay that if it does, if there is some inequality there?
I think those inequalities remain, and they're tough to sort out. The gold standard is... at this point, an attorney at arraignment or discussion at that point. And that doesn't happen everywhere, and it's nearly impossible to implement on the resources that we have to have attorneys available prior to the appointment process. And legally, you have to go through the financial inquiry, which can take time. And cases and the nature of cases can change in that period of time, and the lack of an attorney can have an impact on a case. There's some view that, and some public defenders are available prior to even charging, that when somebody's being investigated and they seek counsel, that they can self-appoint. And so those issues are debated about the cost of that and the appropriateness of that before someone is even charged. But again, those can have impacts, and obviously there's an inequality there. People without money have very little opportunity to consult with a lawyer when they know they're being investigated, whereas somebody with the means to do so can certainly seek counsel. And no doubt that has an impact on cases.
Anyone else on the panel? Rich, I don't know if you have an opinion about that, or Judge Carter, Karen Hoffler, Ms. Loeffler. No?
I mean, you know, obviously I'm the only prosecutor on this group, but and I had, in my first 12 years as a federal prosecutor, it was all private defense attorneys in the cases that I had. And often, you know, you're doing corporate cases and they all come forward and say, I represent everybody. But what I would hope and what we all strive for is that it doesn't make a difference in the outcome. Because, and I, you know, when I come up, I'll talk about our joint, you know, view of serving justice. And it's not perfect, but you certainly try to, as a prosecutor, say, you know, if this person didn't have an attorney and they did this and this person got that, well, I'm going to try to treat this person the same. I mean, generally the law in the federal system is you don't get an attorney and the Sixth Amendment doesn't apply until you're charged. But unless actions are violent, obstructive beforehand, you know, we do have discussions about trying to make sure that the outcome to the person is fair, regardless. Richard?
Well, the Criminal Justice Act plan for Alaska does allow for appointment of counsel prior to being charged if they're a grand jury witness or if they're, you know, under certain circumstances. And as far as the quality of counsel, I've always been an advocate of when somebody is first appointed an attorney, it is that attorney that's representing him, not an office. I mean, I've been in offices before where somebody will handle the case at the beginning if it gets to this level, somebody else. And I think it's an important, that attorney-client relationship is important. And to me, and that's why, you know, we try to have that type of single representation all the way through on a case as much as possible. We have a CJA panel of private attorneys that are appointed in cases, and those are selected by a committee of more experienced CJA attorneys and the judges. But we try to have, you know, the private attorneys who represent conflict cases be as well trained as we can, and because we do this every day, they don't. But, you know, as we all know, lawyers are not all created equal, and so some lawyers are better than others. That's just, you know, that's part of the landscape we deal with. But I think, you know, my office really does everything we can to make sure somebody gets the best representation as possible, and that's why we spend a lot of time training panel attorneys who, you know, will take cases that on appointment.
Thank you. Judge Card, I know you were planning on talking about alternatives, where else we've been in the federal system or the state system and what we used to do.
Well, thank you. Well, thank you for giving me this opportunity. I came to the bar, I think it was pre-Dana Fabe when they had the public defender, and pre-Rich Kirtner, Nancy Shaw in the federal system. So as I opened my office when I left the Air Force in 1981, I would sometimes get a call from Judge Fitzgerald. And Judge Fitzgerald, in his wonderful way, would, since we were such close friends, would address me and he'd say, Larry, I got this friend who needs a lawyer, and I thought of you. And when Judge Fitzgerald called and requested that you represent somebody in a federal court, it really wasn't a request. Judge Fitzgerald was so nice about it, and he wanted to get you to his office and talk about World War II. He and I are both history buffs in that regard, but he would say, oh, this young man needs a lawyer bad, and I thought of you, so, you know, why don't you come on over? And what are you gonna say to Judge Fitzgerald? Judge, I can't afford to. I just opened my office. You say, yes, Judge, I'll be over to get look at the file, and that's what happened. So we had that type of relationship, and, of course, in the court, it made no difference, and we were paid, a very modest amount of money. It wasn't an hourly rate even. It may have been a flat sum, as Quinn was talking about for the state. It wasn't a lot of money, but you could get some really interesting, tough cases. I had federal experience, and I was practicing in federal court some, so I guess They didn't have a CJA panel. No one was training us. But, you know, they used to say if you breathe on a mirror and you could see a little vapor on the mirror that you were effective for federal court. And that's the way it was, I think. So anyway, that's the way the appointment was. But I thought I'd like to go through a little bit of a broader history. We have state history. We have some history in the audience. I've seen Judge Carlson and Justice Fabe and Chief Justice Fabe. And, of course, Rich is now becoming history in the state of in the federal system. He always asks me to talk to his class, which I enjoy. I think he'd like to be a teacher, but he ends up going to court. But anyway, back in 1853, a case called Webb versus Bear happened in Indiana, 6 Indiana 13. And the Indiana Supreme Court recognized the right of an attorney at public expense for an indigent person accused of a crime, grounding in, quote, they called the principles of civilized society, not in either constitutional or any statutory law at the time. And that was the law in Indiana. When we come down to the Sixth Amendment, of course, we talk about the Johnson versus Zerps in 1938, where the court said in all criminal prosecution, the accused shall enjoy the right to have the assistance of counsel, Sixth Amendment. They decided the federal proceeding right was established by both federal statute and reaffirmed by the Supreme Court of the United States in 1938 in Johnston versus Zerbst. And, of course, Webb versus Bear was the exception rather than the rule in states. The Webb case, the Indiana case I just told you about, they, well into the 20th century, most states relied only on volunteer pro se counsel. In other words, I know and was represented that in Michigan, even now, judges are elected, not appointed. So therefore, judges, I'm sure no harm intended, maybe not even, but people that help pay for elections get their firm appointed to do cases, and usually young lawyers in that firm get appointed to represent the defendants. And we are way, way from that in the state of Alaska. But we only use still in some states volunteer pro bono efforts, even for most serious crimes. New York in 1896 had a right to counsel for the needy immigrants, and the first public defender's office began in 1974 in Los Angeles. And for example, the U.S. we were ahead, way ahead, when Judge then public defender Victor Carlson was into the business. U.S. Supreme Court decided that through the 6th and 14th Amendment, the right to counsel, of course, in Powell versus Alabama, and the famous Scottsboro cases. That was during the Depression, where these black men were accused of raping this white woman in Alabama. And the court held that counsel was required in all state capital proceedings. Not all proceedings, but all state capital proceedings. So a decade later, the Betts versus Brady case, where the U.S. Supreme Court declined to extend the Sixth Amendment right to counsel to state felony proceedings. And so not until 1963, some 21 years later, after Betts, the court again addressed that issue involving state counsel involving serious non-capital of crimes. And there were a series of decisions where the Supreme Court established the right to counsel in virtually all aspects of state criminal proceedings. 22 attorney generals, other like, well, he thought like one, but 22 state attorney generals joined the petition of Clarence Earl Gideon. You might add that, Professor. In the Gideon versus Wainwright case, which overruled Betts versus Brady, and the court unanimously held that the Sixth Amendment protection through the 14th extended to all defendants charged with felonies in state courts. Felonies in state courts. So 4 years later, N. Ray Gault brought juveniles into proceedings, of course, extended to children the same rights of counsel in juvenile delinquency proceedings. The right to counsel, again, extended to misdemeanors in state courts in Argesinger versus Hamblin, where there was a potential loss of liberty. So this happened over a period of time, as we all know. I know it's a summary from law school, but we all haven't thought about it in a long time. We're kind of where we are. In summary, the decision of Gideon, Gault, Argesinger covered some 30 years in our country, but were part of a broader array of cases regarding people charged with crime and other people who could not afford to hire a lawyer. So now we have issues of post-arrest interrogation. We have Miranda versus Arizona in 1966 and Williams in 1977. We have lineup issues in U.S. versus Wade in 1967 and other identification procedures in Moore versus Illinois in 1977, where we have talked about one-person show-ups. We have preliminary hearings in Coleman versus Alabama in 1970. We talked about arraignments in Hamilton versus Alabama in 1961, and plea negotiations even. So we're talking about Brady versus United States and McMahon versus Richardson both in 1970. So these are all before I went to law school. Some of you had finished. Some of you weren't even born, looks like, in the crowd. Post-conviction, indigent defendants constitutionally guaranteed the right to counsel in sentencing proceedings. That's Townsend versus Burke in 1948 and U.S. versus Tucker in 1972. Appeals rights, appeal of right per Douglas versus California in 1963, and in some cases, the probation parole revocation proceedings. We have Amempa versus Ray in 1967. Further expanded into collateral proceedings, such as quasi-criminal proceedings, such as mental health competency exams, commitment proceedings, extradition proceedings, prison disciplinary proceedings, status hearings for juveniles, some family matters, such as non-payment of court order support, you can go to jail for contempt, proceedings as well as child dependency, abuse, and neglect situations. All those now, I don't know if your office gets into it, require counsel at times. Finally, any criminal proceeding in which any counsel appears, the defendant is entitled to, quote, effective assistance. So we've gotten fancier. And that means more than just your breath on the mirror. We have the Strickland versus Washington standard in 1984. Guidelines for criminal defendants were provided for both the state and federal commissions by the U.S. Department of Justice back in a comprehensive, quote, guideline for legal defense in the United States in 1976. There are still serious problems that you've heard from Mr. Steiner, Mr. Kirtner, because it talks about, basically about money. States are frequently not implementing standards that are used in that booklet. Contracts are often awarded to the lowest bidder. In other words, the states will have to have private counsel be appointed without regard to the scope of the or quality of their services. Workloads are high. I haven't heard either Mr. Kirtner or Mr. Steiner say anything about low workloads. They've talked about thousands of cases versus hundreds earlier when they were first appointed. And the breadth, where Judge Carlson was the public defender to cover a state as large as two-thirds of the continental United States with five people, seems ridiculous. But anyway, workloads continue to be high. They haven't kept pace with the other components of the justice system, that is, prosecution. So the effects are low quality of representation. Lawyers just don't have time to do the work. I mean, you grab a file and you're going to trial on a major case. You haven't even seen the file. Pro se, no representation at all. Delays, overturned convictions, and convictions of the innocent. So the Innocence Project has been established, as you folks are aware of. A problem still exists. It's not an easy way. We can't do justice cheaply. I guess the final thing is the work still continues. The young lawyers still get overworked. The courts are still overloaded. I know that it's not just the defenders who are busy. I know the prosecutors are busy too, but it's the funding. And maybe, you know, the legislature has to continue to work with this issue. So anyway, I thought it was a great time to summarize what's gone on during my lifetime, my 35 years or 36 years practicing. A lot's happened. And some of the same problems exist, but not the same problems. We don't have people who do primarily civil law being grabbed by the judge and given a call and asked to defend a serious case without any knowledge. The standards are higher than that, but sometimes the results are not as good. But hopefully people are getting representation who have a better chance than, let's say, not getting just a public defender, because many people on the street, I mean, I've represented people privately. I've been a prosecutor, and I know people don't feel that they get good representation from, quote, public defenders. They get the best representation from public defenders because they do it every day. They are the specialists. So that's my comment on it, and I hope it's a nice summary of what, an extension of what Mr. Kirtner said and Mr. Steiner said. So any questions? Since I lived through some of this, I can tell you it was a frightening call to get a call from Judge Fitzgerald, even though he's a nice man. So.
Thank you, Judge Carr. I'm curious, from your time as a prosecutor and your time as a judge, what it was like dealing with pro se defendants, and
something like 82 or 83% of our criminal defendants qualify for public defenders, publicly appointed counsel. What would it have been like if you were a prosecutor or a judge and you had to face a caseload of 82, 83% pro se litigants?
Well, as a prosecutor, I never faced any pro se defendants. As a judge, I've seen many. I mean, it's not an absolute right, and I really discourage it. I always tell them the prosecutor has a professional, you know, you want somebody to help you. So we get different questions. We get the issue of whether there's going to be quasi-representation, some hybrid, or whether they want to do it on their own. There's a few people that do it on their own. They don't do it very well, but they do it. I tell them they don't have a right to complain about their lawyer if they're doing their own work. And some people think, well, maybe they all have a lawyer so they can have somebody to complain about. But as you folks know that have done this work, some of the people you work so hard for will file those ineffective petitions so quickly you wonder if it's the same case. But that's their right. And so we respect the right. As judges, I respect the right when I defend people privately, and we just have to take it as it comes. So,
Ms. Laffer, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, what it would be like.
Oh, well, I'm actually going to give a few examples of what, when you want to get into mine, sure. A little of what happens to people that represent themselves and why it's a really bad idea, because both as supervisor and U.S. attorney, I've seen the people do it, and I will comment from, I stole this from one of the guys in my office who refers to it as a defendant's constitutional right to maximize their own punishment, which is generally the outcome of that. And that was part of my conversation about why the professionalism of the public defender and CJA and those of you who are in private practice coming forward is so important. But I have specific examples.
Please.
All right. Are you, okay.
Yeah, please.
Actually, I want to... let me just start with mine. I want to read you something. If an obscure Florida convict named Clarence Earl Gideon had not sat down in his prison cell with a pencil and paper to write a letter to the Supreme Court, and if the court had not taken the trouble to look for merit in that one crude petition, the vast machinery of American law would have gone on functioning undisturbed. But Gideon did write that letter, the court did look into his case, and the whole course of American legal history has been changed. That's a quotation from then Attorney General Robert Kennedy in November 1, 1963. The Gideon case, if you recall, was March 1963. And the reason I wanted to start with that is that the search for justice and having the system work for justice is not a defense attorney prosecution, controversy. We all believe, and the Attorney General of the United States, even back then, jumped on immediately and said, you know, we can't make justice perfect, but we can try to make the system function and function well. And anybody who has ever seen me at any of the national forums, back when we had them because there were money that we were allowed to travel, know that I'm a very parochial defender of not only my office, but Alaska and the Alaska Bar. And one of the big benefits of this is we know each other. I've actually known Judge Card even longer than Rich Kirtner, shockingly enough, but because we can, when there are issues in terms of how process is being done, you know, we can talk to each other and we generally solve them. We get in fights about, you know, if a client wants to go to trial and he wants, okay, there's a system and there's a set of rules and you argue about that in the courtroom. If the system's not functioning, we get together and talk about it. And that's who we are as a bar. I want to add another thing that Rich said, and that is that, and let me just tell you this, you know, when I came to Alaska in 1985, I think I joined the state and then became a DA, I took a pay cut to become a public servant, even back then, and I wasn't paid that much. I was pretty new, but I was in private practice in Minnesota. And to this day, back 3 years ago when I was last allowed to hire, we were hiring people who took pay cuts to become public servants. So both the public defenders, the CJA, the people that work there. I mean, take a lot of pride in the word public servant because we're there serving the community. And the profession that we're serving is the justice profession. I think everybody strives in our community to make it better. I want to talk a little bit about what that means, going forward. Now, in Alaska, we do have a professional public defense system, thank goodness. Over my 25 years in the U.S. Attorney's Office, we've occasionally had problems with defense attorneys who were not being professional, not looking up the discovery, not, you know, sitting down with their clients so they understood the system. Of course, it was never once a public defender because they are professionals. They know their jobs. They know the system. It was almost never, you know, a CJA, a person who was trained or whatever, because there is a, you know, we all know there's somewhat arcane rules, and the federal court can be even more arcane than the state. And you need to understand it, and the whole goal is that the client has to be able to make a reasoned choice, right, Rich? And to do that takes time, takes even more time with some of your clients. But the public defender system in Alaska has always been very, very professional. And Rich, by the way, didn't pay me to say this. You know, we may have our disputes over individual cases and things like that, but the importance of a professional defense bar is, you know, I've never worked without public defenders, but is something that's actually essential to the running of the system. And I did say that I would, because I've been here forever. I think I know at least half the room, and it's all the old people. And some of you I know from hockey, but, you know, because you're in the private bar, Chris. But anyway, you know, what happens, of course, when people represent themselves? I mean, we had the question, well, you know, here's just a couple of examples of, we did have I remember a case, it was a fraud case, and the guy was a little nutty, as they are, who insisted on representing himself. And from the prosecutor's perspective, we had a very, very professional postal inspector who had been a Marine, was very soft-spoken, very professional. And he's on the stand being asked about what color he dreams in. And all sorts of, and the judge was sort of going, well, you know, the prosecutor tried to object once or twice, and the judge went, you know, oh, pro se, do what you want. And the poor guy, you know, came out after an hour and said, you know, I mean, he was asking about his family, where he drove to here, and all sorts of things. And, you know, he wandered around for a while and managed to maximize his sentence. You know, we had another case with I think it was a robbery defendant who ended up watching the trial from the marshal's cell because he wouldn't listen to his attorney. And these are some people with, you know, mental problems. And if he, of course, got the maximum sentence. Those who listen to their attorney and sit down and learn the system usually, you know, still 90% of the time, work out a deal. What does a deal mean? A deal means that here's your risk and you manage to minimize it and hopefully get, you know, a little better for the client. Nowadays, what I see more in pro se, if it's not somebody that's really has mental problems, is to be honest, it's the tax protesters, you know, who try to run through five or six different attorneys and they can't find somebody who will make the claims that they want to make in front of the system. But ultimately, the result of every one of these, and I suspect the we have any federal judges here? We got state judges, but you would have had the same thing, is that generally the result of pro se representation is more time in jail. Because most of our cases settle. Most of our cases settle because, you know, the experienced attorneys sit down, they know the risks, they can lay them out for their clients, and they figure out what is the best for them. So, you know, the core of making the system work is, of course, for prosecutors to be do their best to do justice, to be fair. We certainly work very hard at that, and I certainly know, because I know most of the people, if there's a problem, I expect that our criminal chief or myself will get a call. We did in my history once have one assistant in the office who, I was not the U.S. attorney, and the U.S. attorney did not trust his judgment in being somebody that was, that the defense bar was comfortable calling up, and that person no longer works in my office. But you know, that's not the goal. The goal is it's up to the client to make the decision, but to do so, he has to have people who spend the time to explain who the client trusts, who knows the system, and that's the federal public defenders. And I am also out here, you know, arguing for all of you in the private bar. The CJA panel always needs to be expanded. If it is, and you have young people in your private firms who want to take a case, they need to consult with the public defenders. And the other thing is you can call us up. We do show up at least once or, I don't know, twice a year, Rich, to the CJA panel lunches. The criminal chief or myself will come over. You know, we will wear the appropriate armored plated uniforms and take the arrows that are shot. But the purpose of going is if people want to say, you know, what are your policies? How does this work? How do we work with you? You know, we do that because the system only works when we work together on making it as fair a system as we can. I do want to talk about, finally, some of the things that it's not a static system. I suspect every judge and every lawyer in the room could think of ways to say, how do we make this better? How do we make the procedures less arcane and the system more understandable? And that just takes us working together as a bar whenever we have meetings, whenever you have committee meetings. Generally, when somebody comes up with a good idea, it's actually not defense prosecution. It's like, that would be a good idea to streamline it and in this time of reduced resources, give people the time to focus on the key issues. And that's not a static idea, and that takes everybody. And one of the other, and I said, here's one of the ideas that as a prosecutor came forward in my career. When I first got here, we always had public defenders. I've never worked in a situation where people were required to go to trial without an attorney. I can't imagine anybody thinking that was, you know, justice. But I have worked in a situation where victims had no say. And I do think one of the advances we've made as we tried to make justice better is the advances where victims had a right to appear in court to say something. Because when I was first a prosecutor, it was not a judge from this district, you know, in a murder case. Clearly had no interest and didn't want the victims to say anything. Wanted to be able to sort of have this clean little discussion of what he wanted to do without actually having to hear, you know, a dispute from the victim. And I think that's an advancement that went on. And, you know, that wasn't started by prosecutors. It was started by victims' advocacy groups. So, you know, as we as a bar, we just have to, and as a prosecutor, have to have our ears open with good ideas about how to make the system better. But the bar here is very professional. The judges are professional. We all, I think, walk into a courtroom. We all have personal biases, but you hear stories around the country about walking into a judiciary that, like, is for one side or the other. We don't have that here at all. And, you know, the system just, I think all of us here, you just work to try to make it actually a little less arcane, get some of the, and make sure that everybody in the room knows what's going on. And if those few cases where the client wants to go to trial, it's because he wants to and he understands the system. And I think that's true every time that the client has a public defender. They know it. They know the system. They know the understanding. And that's what the only thing that works when we're prosecutors. We don't want to be responsible for our part of the case and also feeling that the defendant doesn't know what's going on. So anyway, and that's kind of me going forward. Again, the other thing I will join with Rich in is this whole issue. I can't leave any function without talking about sequestration and the effects it has on everybody. And the sort of constant downgrading of what it means to be a public servant. I take great pride in the public service of both my office and Rich's, who I know. And the lawyers from my side are being held to a higher and higher standard. They don't dispute the higher standard. They are happy to strive for it. But being told to do it when you can't have any staff and any paper and any pens and any training is a joint problem. So I don't make political speeches, but I'm joining Rich in that one. It's unfair to all of us to try to make the system run without any of the basic resources. Anyway, I'm happy to answer questions, and even if it's from the defense bar, you know, I'll put on my bulletproof vest and answer the best I can.
Thank you. You were talking about making the system run smoother and expansions to incorporate victims and other people in the system that we have. I'm curious what your thoughts are on. Occasionally, we hear about the question: when will there be a civil Gideon? And should civil defendants who are indigent get publicly appointed counsel? And does it make a difference if the government is the plaintiff? If the federal government or the state of Alaska is suing someone who can't afford a lawyer, should the federal government or the state provide a lawyer for them?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. Although in my office, we're mainly the defendants in civil suits. I mean, our office does more medical malpractice case for size than any other office in the country. And I think that you're asking me more of a thing that says, is the American system, if we priced ourselves out of justice for civil litigants, how many people out there, you do much more private. I mean, I think that's yes, but that's me reading the papers and going, you know, even more for plaintiffs, how in the world, and I know we have a contingency fee theory, but our legal system is so expensive that I think there's lots of injustice on the civil side, but I don't know that public appointment is the answer. We don't do a lot of suing individual people in my office. We're usually on the defense side, and when we're suing Publicly, it's usually like, you know, the state versus us over environmental regulations and things like that. You know, we're actually not out there in vans running over people and taking money out of their pockets. As far as I know, if we are, let me know. But it's just not an issue that comes up that much.
Does anyone else have a comment on that? Go ahead.
My comment would simply be if they do have a civil Gideon, then we all advocate that it be handled by the Office of Public Advocacy.
Right.
Other than that, it's fine with me.
Yeah. Good point. Sorry to say that was a good point.
Rick Allen's not here, so I can say that.
Yeah, unfortunately, he can't defend himself. Yeah. Well, it seems like one of the persistent themes of today has been funding. And in preparing for today, I read an article from 2 years ago about Anthony Rollins, that he qualified for a public defender even though he and his wife together had made over $1 million in the previous 6 years. This is according to the Anchorage Daily News. I think most people, when they read that, they thought, holy smokes, how can someone who's made over $1 million in the past 6 years qualify for a public defender? And is it just that private lawyers cost so much? And is the fact that that lawyers cost so much just generally, is that part of the problem? And does anyone have any thoughts on reducing those costs?
Those cases, unclassified felonies and hate felonies, have become so complicated that the time it puts into it, I think few people have the money and resources to actually fund the case appropriately. It doesn't surprise me on a case like that somebody would obtain a public defender. Part of the issues for us come in on sort of middle-level cases when it's a closer call, you know, C felonies and DUI cases, when we have these huge numbers of cases where people are borderline. You know, we're a limited resource. And I feel quite strongly about the idea that we really should only be working on cases where folks are truly indigent and they don't have the ability to hire their own lawyer. If they have that ability, they need to hire a lawyer. We should be focusing on the folks who actually cannot, because every time we're representing somebody who has money, that's taking time away from somebody who couldn't otherwise make that choice. Regardless about how you'd feel about the idea of appointments in all criminal cases, that's not what we have. And it's critical. The caseloads go up every single year. There's just an ever-increasing number of criminal cases filed in appointments. You know, and that, I think, just to tie it back around to one of the things I was talking about earlier, about the public and the bar's involvement in criminal legislation, there's a lot of policy-oriented legislation that's designed to reduce crime and can save, by estimates that are credible and have been established in other parts of the country, hundreds of millions of dollars. And it's not just money, it's reducing the number of victims. These policies are being currently debated in the legislature with little input from the public or the bar. And they're profoundly important, and there's potential for passing some of this legislation, and I would encourage people to pay attention to some of these initiatives, and if you're inclined, to become educated and voice your opinion on what the best policy is.
Well, I'll also weigh in on, you know, sorry guys, some of that is judge related. I mean, I actually have had a, you know, case of a banker that at one point had the public defender and at the same time had a name partner from Chicago arguing the appeal against me and had a very expensive San Francisco attorney in the trial. And, you know, you can ask as a prosecutor, you know, did we originally say this guy doesn't qualify for a public defender? And he said, well, but if I lose the bank case, I'll have restitution of $40 million, so therefore my net worth is potentially zero. And the answer to me is, I got to prosecute. I'm not going to beat my head against that wall if the judge wants to give him a public defender. And sometimes I can understand the judges, like in federal court, sort of going, well, I tell him to get his own attorney, but I've now had three arraignments and he doesn't have one yet because he wants to get an attorney for free. You know, Rich's group, thank goodness, is willing to take it so we can move the case forward. And that's the, if you want the practical story about how that happens sometimes in federal court, that's how it does. And I have more, I mean, mostly I just stay out of it. You know, I mean, I'm supposed to be representing the public fisc, but we don't have enough time to, you know, appropriately put together the best way we can do the case. So we just stay out of it. And that does happen. It just I think judges get frustrated at, you know, if he didn't get an attorney, and how long do we just sit there and keep telling him to get one? And that's happened in a number of cases that I've done, and, you know, and thank goodness, at least federally, the defense attorney, the FPD doesn't really get involved in that fight either, because they're going like, okay, if the court tells me to take them, I'll take them. And that sometimes I'd say was between the court and the defendant.
You know, when I first started practice, it was never a problem because if people could afford to hire an attorney, they did, because there was not much of a reputation for public defenders. And that's really changed in my career, where people may lie in order to get a public defender appointed. My office has represented lawyers, doctors, bankers, some of the people who used to be the richest people in Alaska until they got in trouble. But it's really an expensive proposition on a big federal criminal case to try to hire a private attorney. It is the fees that are quoted just to get started are pretty high. And so, I mean, I think it's a tough, you know, it's got to be a standard that has to apply to each particular case. And, you know, the judges make that determination. The judges decide who qualifies for appointed counsel. But, you know, we get a lot of cases where you might at first think they wouldn't qualify for public counsel, but it's just an expensive proposition to hire an attorney in most cases.
Did you have something more you wanted to add?
No, I agree with Rich. I mean, you know, as I said, I will echo, the public defenders are very good. And some people just want to say, well, why should I pay? I know I can get good attorneys. And it's really between the judges, I think. I mean, we like to stay out of it.
Well, we have a little bit of time for questions from the floor. Is there a microphone in the back that can get sent around? Yeah? Does anyone have questions?
Yeah.
If you just wait for the microphone, it'll get over there in just a moment.
Yes, two comments and one question. Comment one on the topic that you were just discussing about whether the right people are appointed and how it's really the responsibility of the judges. I think the court system really agrees, and we have just undertaken quite an extensive internal audit of our court's appointment practices, taking a random period of time and then actually transcribing each and every one of the appointments and making sure and actually following up, if someone says they're on public assistance, following up to track to make sure that that was a truthful answer. So I think we'll have those results. They're still being compiled, but it's my understanding of the preliminary information is that the error rate is actually quite tiny. I think out of over 350 cases, fewer than 2% had even a question mark as to whether there might have been an issue or an inaccuracy about the report by the defendant. The second thing I just think, I'm the fourth of the seven public defenders for the state who are here. Before me came Judge Carlson, Judge Vic Carlson, and then Herb Soule, and then Brian Shortell, and after me, John Salemi, Barb Brink, and now Quinlan. But I think all of the six of us who followed Vic Carlson must give him the credit for establishing the procedures within the Office of Excellence and the standards of excellence, which we all followed. He really was committed to making sure that people not only had a free defense, but a defense by an expert who was trained and who was there to provide the best service possible. So I think we all owe a huge debt of thanks to him. And the last point is a question, actually, for Quinn. I know when we used to do our annual report, we would figure out how many cases we had and what our total budget was, and if we divided the number of cases, total number of cases into the budget, we could come up with a figure, and again, it's a very rough estimate because the murder case is going to take longer than a DUI that pleads, but of the cost per case, and I think something that hasn't been emphasized today is the efficiency with which a public defender agency can operate because of the expertise. Not only is the quality of the defense and the representation excellent, but it really reduces the cost to the public of the cost to defend each case. And so maybe, Quinn, you could tell us if you have those numbers or at least the rough sense of how many cases your office does and what the cost is.
Yeah, we still calculate those every year just to see how well we compare to what the cost of private counsel is. Like I said, we handle approximately 26,000 appointments a year, and if you average it just by the number of appointments, it's a little less than $1,000 per case, $900 or some odd dollars per case. We also have a way of weighting the cases based upon the ABA standards for criminal representation. So the average felony case is about, I think, $1,500 to resolve. An unclassified felony, a homicide, we actually can resolve for less than $10,000 over the course of the entire state. And that's not that we're spending little time on each and every case, but we're able to sort of adjust to what the case deserves. And we get the efficiencies and the economies of scale with specialists. You know, misdemeanors we can resolve for somewhere less than $400, I think. And I'm just going off of memory, but I am in the process of calculating that. And when you compare that to the amount of time any individual case takes on average, and you look at it from a private attorney's perspective, it's much more efficient and still delivering a high level of service. And that's much of what we concentrate on, is being able to deliver that level of service to each and every client for what each and every case deserves. And Karen referenced this before. The bulk of what we do, and I'm not sure if everyone knows this, but the bulk of what we do is we talk to clients and advise them about their case so that they can make an informed decision. And that process can never, that can't be done easily. It can't be made more efficient. You just have to go talk to your client, get to know your client. Your client has to get to know you. They have to trust you so they can tell you what they need to tell you, and they accept and understand that you're working in their interests and giving them advice, because it's their decision. What flows from that, we're responsible for, but they have a key decision to make, which is trial or to plead and whether or not to testify. And that process, just, it's hard to make more efficient, and there's lots of barriers to getting that done, but it is the principal part of our job. And that's our challenge.
Other questions?
I guess we stand, huh? The judge having set the standard. For those that don't know me, which may be everybody under 50, I'm the guy that wrote that letter that was quoted at the beginning there. And my question, which is, and I'll follow up with an explanation of it, is my question is, why don't we do more? And I guess in many respects, I think that Gideon has left lawyers with a sense of complacency about the conditions of the criminal justice system that is not justified by facts. We, at the time of Gideon, we look back with satisfaction at the kind of law described a century earlier in Dickens, you know, in Bleak House, etc. We've come some further distance from Dickens, but I don't think we've come anywhere near as far as we could if lawyers didn't enjoy a certain complacency. Now, part of that complacency, I would say, comes from the assumption that the system is providing equal counsel around the system. And I think every ordinary person, not lawyer, that I know would say, well, of course it's not equal justice. You know, and every time you turn around, there's another case in the court, starting with a classic O.J. case, of course, where money counts. We have a market system on justice, criminal justice, as well as civil. And as a consequence, rich people get better representation. That's the way it goes, isn't it? I mean, it's pretty hard to deny that, even though we don't like to admit to it. So as far as the public defender's office goes, which, of course, in roles I've had in the state, I've supported as best I could. It seems to me the public defender has been, in many respects, I listen to those caseloads, and you're reduced to case management as the style. You know, you allocate resources given that you're getting another 30 cases this morning on your desk. How are you going to take care of this stuff? And a private, of course, a private person that has the wherewithal doesn't do that at all. There's no limit to the amount of resources that can be put into a particular case. You can take a sort of a recent example of a case of a Kennedy shirt-tail relative that paid over $1 million for a lawyer, and now he has the chutzpah to go in and for on a petition for lack of proper representation by counsel. Sure, they're going to be spend another $1 million on that. So resources do make a difference. The application and the public defender, from the point of view of the legislature, has always had sort of a negative image because they're there to defend criminals, right? That's the way the legislature looks at it. The average legislator is not a lawyer. They're there defending criminals. So why on earth do we give them a big budget? I think the proper measure of caseload is to compare it with the prosecutor's office and see, you know, what's their caseload, what are the resources that have been applied. I once discussed that at some length with Herb Soll, who was mentioned as one of the second public defender. But there are serious political problems, as you members of the panel know, and actually making progress when you have that public attitude. That same business of costs, it seems to me, affects this issue of whether whether you have a line and you only provide defense to the indigent. What you have to know is that beyond that line, a case where you are may well be innocent, or maybe in some cases innocent, and you are bankrupted, a defendant, that is bankrupted by the cost of lawyers, which you already pointed out, private lawyers cost a lot. A lot of the reason they charge so high, incidentally, is because a lot of their clients don't pay, but they continue to the case anyway. It's not that criminal justice lawyers make fortunes. We're exceptions. Another of the issues that you touched on, and Larry Card in particular was talking about the history and so on. One of the problems is that we don't do anything about is over imprisonment. I don't think that the American public has become more criminally inclined over the last century. In fact, it's probably quite the opposite. But we imprison more than we ever have, and particularly on the federal side, of course, for the federal drug offenses, doubled it up. And one asks, you know, where is the community of lawyers who should know that we're way over incarcerating? I'll admit to some responsibility in that area because I thought that presumptive sentencing might be a good idea at one time when I might have had some influence, and I'll never make it past purgatory on my involvement in having that come in. And obviously we need to give the judges back far more of the discretion that we've taken away from them and which they need, because all cases are different. And you've also touched on the disastrous consequences for people who are involved in private litigation, where we provide no support and where money is all a game. Everybody here who was practices has probably represented clients with very little money going up against corporations that have a whatever it takes attitude towards their representation of the case, and many of these corporations, of course, want to make it an example of whoever brings the suit against them to discouraged so that lawyers will advise their clients, you know, if you ever sue so-and-so, they'll come after you for your fees. They'll do what they can to ruin you, and they'll spend as much, far more time than I can spend in defending their position in the case. So I think it's been a great panel, and you are all major figures, some of you in my own life, in terms of your effect on the law. But my question remains, why don't we do more?
If I can comment, please. First of all, I mean, the short, quick answer is Quinlan and I, I'm sure, do everything we can with the resources we have. We're committed to that. But I think you raised the bigger question that, you know, reflecting on my career, when I started practicing law, since I started practicing law, the population of this state and the population of this nation has doubled. Our prison populations in this state and our prison populations in this country have increased tenfold. You look at how the death penalty is administered in this country. It's insanity. You look at the impact of imprisoning such a large proportion of our population, people of color, minorities, and the influence it has on this country day to day overall. I think anybody stepping out of our day to day roles and looking at what we've created in this country, it's to me, it needs to be addressed, but I think we have to educate the public on that. And the public has to understand what we've created, the machinery we've created that, you know, maybe with good goals in mind, has perhaps got out of our control, where it has, I think, a devastating impact on our economy, on our nation, on the nation's morality and sense of justice. And so I think that's a bigger question that I struggle with whenever I have the time to step outside my day-to-day role and think about, you know, what we do who are part of the system, but we, as much as we would hope to, we can't change it ourselves. It's going to take, you know, our communities to change it, our legislators, but, you know, it starts with the public.
And I just note we're at the end of our time, but so if people have just quick responses, I know it's a big question, but please.
It is a big question. One of the things that we're facing now is a growing jail population rate, and an ever-increasing percentage of the folks in jail are in there for nonviolent drug offenses. One of the states that has been most progressive on this issue is the state of Texas. They were faced with a budget crisis and huge growth in their jail population. They brought that jail growth down to zero in 3 years without changing any criminal laws. They simply focused on rehabilitation and treatment and reducing recidivism. They actually cut crime by pouring money, and they saved hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars and have now actually closed prisons. And these are the kinds of bills and issues that are being debated right now in this state. I believe Corrections is predicting that Goose Creek, which cost $270 million to build, will be full by 2016, and they will need another prison. And so Corrections here is leading this debate with information about how to bring that growth rate down to zero so there's no new prisons. And this has the benefit of saving, in this state, estimated hundreds of millions of dollars, $300 million with a fairly minimal investment, around $30 million over 20 years, and actually cutting the need to build a prison and reducing crime.
Well, I want to thank all of our panelists today, and thank you for attending today.